First you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores, but because you own the money, you see that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim.
Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for, what is it here now? April 17th, 2025. This is a program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Today we'll examine, or we'll continue our recent topic of election integrity, today involving vote suppression. This follows on to last month's program in which we discussed how we got the wrong president yet again due to vote challenges, in that case, exposed by Greg Palast. In the latter half hour today, we'll be discussing the national implications of current vote suppression in North Carolina. And that's over the one and only election in the entire nation that is undecided since Election Day back on November 5th. That's over 5 months ago. But first, in the first half hour or so, let's look at the dangers of the SAVE Act in Congress. That's S-A-V-E, the SAVE Act. That's in Congress right now. Our guest is the president of the League of Women Voters here in Mendocino County, who succeeded the lovely Jane Person, who passed away unexpectedly last year. And so with us is Charlene McAllister, and let's have a look at the dangers of the SAVE Act in Congress right now. Charlene McAllister, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Okay. The SAVE Act, not one of our favorites. Okay. The SAVE Act would require that citizenship documentation in order to register to vote, even though voters in every state are already required to affirm or verify their citizenship status while they're registering. But this bill requires individuals to provide documentary proof of their citizenship when they register to vote in a federal election. And the bill specifies which documents are considered acceptable proof of U.S. citizenship. It's such as an identification that will comply with the Real ID Act of 2005. The League of Women Voters is very concerned about this because voting rights is a major reason we exist. We're a nonpartisan grassroots organization. We've been working to protect and expand voting rights since we were born, which was we came out of the suffrage movement. And we want to ensure that everyone is represented in our democracy. So that's why we're here. That's why we are so concerned about the SAVE Act.
It's interesting that this documentation, I mean, a lot of people have passports and many, many more do not. Who is going to be hit the hardest by having to come up with all of these papers?
Well, when you look really closely at the law, you'll see that it has requirements that may look simple, but they're not. For example, married women, their birth certificate may show their name, but then they have to show proof that they got married. people who have lost their documents in fires and floods, and there's difficulty in getting the right documents, it penalizes the poor. Because Americans do not need more obstacles to voting. As you know, only about a third of the the people who were eligible to vote in the United States didn't vote at all. So we don't need more obstacles. We need fewer, right? the SAVE Act would create one more barrier to the voting process, as many eligible voters don't have easy access to those necessary documents. Compared to white U.S. citizens, citizens of color are three times more likely to lack the documents such as birth certificates, passports, naturalization certificates, or any certificates of citizenship, or they face difficulties accessing them. For example, while approximately half of all American adults possess a passport, two-thirds of Black Americans do not.
Yeah, so it's going to hit people of color and women and, as you said, poor people. So would you think that this is really a problem of illegal voting, or is this out-and-out voter suppression?
Well, I think it is definitely out-and-out voter, definitely is voter suppression. Because if you look at, were there really that many illegal voters? Illegal people who weren't supposed to vote. When they did a comprehensive audit of Georgia's voter rolls, which included 8.2 million registered voters, they uncovered 20 non-citizens who registered to vote. Now, notice that they say they uncovered it, which means that they found out who wasn't registered. And they included nine times when non-citizens actually cast a ballot. A similar audit in Iowa showed they have 2.3 million voters, and they found 87 instances where individuals cast ballots and later reported that they were non-citizens. In Ohio, the state's attorney general announced indictments against six alleged non-citizens who actually voted in a national election. And they did identify 500 some odd alleged non-citizens who had registered to vote, but each of the six defendants were lawful residents, but they actually lacked citizenship when they voted. Now, notice that they know who those people were, so they caught them. Mm-hmm. So it is, many people are willing to believe that illegals have voted because they say it so often. And, if you repeat, you repeat a lie often enough, people believe it.
It's one of the techniques in the modern world, begun a little over 100 years ago. So let's look at the other side of the issue then, as far as numbers go. So there's a few handfuls of illegal people that either were registered or did actually vote. The opposite side is a whole big numbers of people are not going to be able to vote till they get their papers together, or find them, or replace them, get them recreated, et cetera. So what are those numbers look like?
The numbers of people that I don't think we know of how many people will have difficulty getting this up. But I would think that at least half of the registered voters we have out there would have difficulty proving again that they're citizens.
Yeah, it's in the millions, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be a lot of people. Yeah. There are a few of us who are lucky enough to have that passport. But again, each time you register to vote and each time you come in to vote, you'll have to show it again.
Congress passed the SAVE Act. And now it's on the way to the Senate. It was mostly Republicans, and I think
the House passed it.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
Congress.
Oh, okay, the House, with the help of four Democrats, but it's mostly a partisan thing. It's mostly Republican. So now it's on its way to the Senate. Do you have any predictions about what's going to happen there?
No, I don't. But I do remember that it didn't pass the last time they brought this up. So hopefully that it won't pass this time. There is a 60 vote rule in the Senate. Now, I know that our local senators will definitely vote in against it. And so it's a good time to write to them and say thank you in advance for how they vote, because I think that's always a good move to thank them. But if anybody has friends or family in other states, write to them. Tell them, urge them to write to their senators and say, vote no on the SAVE Act.
And there is the issue of they would have to, the Republicans would have to pass it despite the Democrats' ability in this case to filibuster. So that pretty much,
yeah.
And that 60 vote number that you mentioned, so that is the number of votes required in the Senate to overcome a filibuster.
Yes.
Okay, and the current Senate is 53-47, I believe, with Republicans in the majority. So there's a number 7 of non-Republicans that are needed to overcome a filibuster. Any idea the chances of that?
I wish I had the magic ability to tell you how that was going to turn out, but I don't. You know, I think we've just got our fingers crossed and hope that if we make enough noise about this,
yeah.
I know that the league is very definitely fighting very hard to, on a national level mm-hmm. to keep this from passing. They're in Congress. When Congress is in session, they're there all the time talking to their, and we are a national organization, so we're not just California. So, so hopefully we'll have an ability to make a difference in this.
Meanwhile, President Trump signed an executive order preserving and protecting the integrity of American elections. Is this another way of getting the SAVE Act through? What is
It is. It's very similar to the SAVE Act. I did read it through, and it's interesting that it requires that everyone vote on like the same day. You have to go in and vote that day, and your vote has to be counted that day. So currently, our system in California, for example, is that you can mail in your ballot, mm-hmm. and as long as it's postmarked by the end of the day, then it's good. We can count it a few days later. This would not allow that to happen. It has more requirements than that too, because it has to do with the fact that there has to be a single uniform voting registration form, a national form. That would be the same for every state. And, that can, since every state is a little bit different, it could cause a lot of chaos out there in the ability of each state would have to suddenly redo how it handles voting registration. So a little
Whoa.
More chaos.
Yeah, something you mentioned about all voting one day. Now, it's in federal law about Election Day, or maybe it's in the Constitution. I forget about being the... Is it the first Tuesday of November?
Yes.
Okay. So, but I'm thinking of, I know what Greg Palast, our guest last month, has said multiple occasions and talked about the infamous Souls to the Polls events uh-huh. that occur like on Sunday or maybe a few Sundays, one or more Sundays just immediately prior to a Tuesday election. That is very common in the Black community. And in their churches. So it's Souls of the Polls right after church on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
So this would upend that for federal elections?
Yes, that's what from my reading of what the his executive order said is that people will only get to vote on the day on voting day and it has to be counted on that day. Well, that's not possible. You can't guarantee the counts that I know what it's like in Mendocino County, and that's not, it's not easy to get all the votes counted in one day. So I can imagine what it's like in a state with 8.2 million registered voters.
Wow, this sounds almost as good as tariffs for total chaos. And it might also look at it as a way of the sidelining Congress. To do all these executive orders, and this being one. The league probably prefers to see matters like this go through Congress where it has the more in touch with the people.
Yeah, actually, the League sent out a letter shortly, and it's been last month, to Congress, reminding them of what their duties are. Because we're real believers in the Constitution. We believe in the checks and balances of the three branches of government. And you know, for the president to take on all the responsibilities that are not by law really aren't his, you know. The Constitution is very clear in that Congress has certain rights and responsibilities, and we are urging them to do their job.
And also, there's something called a U.S. Election Assistant Commission. What do they do? Do they have anything to do with this?
It's interesting because in his executive orders, he basically says that the Election Assistance Commission would have to take action to cease providing federal funds to any states that do not comply with the federal laws mandating that states accept and use the national mail registration form. Okay, so basically what he's added to that, the election assistance commission was to help people vote, right? But in this particular case, they would have to take action. Now, what that action says, I don't know, but they would cease providing federal funds to any state that didn't follow the rules.
This sounds like really complicated. And then California has its own version, or it might. It's a representative from San Diego, a state representative who's a Republican, and he tried to get AB 25 through. I know the League has been fighting AB 25.
Yes, we are. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to the SAVE Act in many ways because it requires that a government ID is needed in order to vote. So it's a bill that would put up new barriers to voting, especially for low-income voters, the elderly, the young voters, and people with disabilities, as well as communities of color. In the name of some non-existent voter fraud, this bill would destabilize our elections with harsh and unnecessary rules that are really designed to block eligible voters from the ballot box, and would again cause chaos in election administration.
I see that DeMaio from San Diego, he also, since he couldn't get his AB 25 out of committee along party lines, the Democrats sunk it, I think, by one vote, 3-2 in committee, that he is going to try to put it on the ballot as an initiative in 2026.
Yes, that's what I see, that it's going to be on the, you know, we'll see if it makes the ballot. You know, I guess it would have to be approved by the assembly in order to get on the ballot, or he would have to, you know, get enough signatures to put it on the ballot. So I would hope that in California that it wouldn't pass, but we don't know, do we?
And then with this California having its own version, then that would be one of the crazy things that we were talking about before, all the different states doing all this. And then you have this overall SAVE Act that is very strict about its provisions. It's going to be crazy, huh?
It really will be. It'll change a lot of things if it does pass. It will make a lot of difference in how we do our elections because, as again, every state is a little different and every state has a slightly different rules. And, you know, I think, as far as I know, California has never had any identified illegal voters ever voting. You know, I couldn't find any evidence that we have. And I think we've got a very good system for voting in our state. And I think it's worked very well for us. And I would really hate to see one of these rules come through, whether it be AB 25 or the SAVE Act or the executive orders that just cause a lot of chaos.
You know, the Gallup polls, when they ask people just real simply, you know, are you in favor of this, you know, citizenship, proving citizenship to vote, you know, but when people just ask that in a poll, they overwhelmingly say yes, because they haven't had a chance to think about the implications of having a a passport or some such thing. So could this be a problem when it, if it ends up on the ballot?
I think it really will be, because I don't think people really understand very much about how difficult it can become to prove that you're a citizen, you know, whether it be a naturalized citizen or born here. And I just think that as a rule, people just, if you ask the question, I mean, I'm certainly in favor of everybody who votes being a citizen, as I'm sure you are. But again, it's when, it's how difficult you make it for people to prove that they're citizens. I mean, I don't think it's something people are going to lie about for the most part, but, and again, we've seen with the checks and balances in other states and all the that it really doesn't present a problem. And it's kind of like trying to fix something that isn't broken.
One more nasty thing about the SAVE Act that I'd like to get your reaction to is apparently it could be chilling for potential election workers, because included are punitive measures for somebody registering somebody who isn't entitled to, I mean, that they could do prison time or things like that.
Yes, and it's actually criminal penalties that would apply. So this is, it really is kind of scary, because, you know, for someone who is taking, you know, you go out to register voters, which we always have done, and you don't, you know, you don't get the proper documentation. And it could just be the person, could be a league person who's out there registering somebody to vote. And because they didn't get the proper documentation, they're subject to criminal penalties.
Oh,
and again, some of these are simply can be because someone is reporting them as having done something wrong. So it's a very difficult situation, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me sum up a little bit. So this, the SAVE Act has passed the House of Representatives, and it's on its way to the Senate. I don't have any timing for that, but the big question now will be, well, what happens in the Senate? If the Democrats filibuster, then 60 votes are required to overcome the filibuster. The ratio of Republicans to Democrats in the Senate is 53 to 47, so there will be seven votes, non-Republican votes, required to meet that 60-vote threshold, and we don't know what's going to happen, of course.
No.
And we should, Charlene McAllister, we should have you tell people how they can catch up with the Mendocino League of Women Voters.
Okay. Yes. one of the things you can do in this time is to join the League of Women Voters, or there's many organizations out there that are doing some great work, like Indivisible is also doing. And you can contact the League of Women Voters through an email. It's info@lwvmendo.org. You can call us at 937-4952. That's 707-937-4952. We also have a website. It's lwvmendo.org. Okay, and I'd like to throw in a little push for on the 27th from 12 to 2 at the Casper Community Center, the Grassroots Institute and the League of Women Voters are co-hosting Assemblyman Chris Rogers, who's coming here for a town hall meeting. So we certainly urge everybody to come, and we can ask him about AB 25 at that time.
Okay, and I have to say that the newsletter that you put out, the Mendocino local and national issues that comes out frequently every month, I believe, from the League, is really excellent. There's so much information in there for Mendocino County people, so thank you for that, and listeners, you should look for that.
Okay, well, we thank Jerry Stavely and Doreen Rayall for the work they do on the newsletter. Yes, it's really an excellent publication.
And all those lists of things that they tell you you can do in this stressful time to make a difference is to support organizations that defend your democracy. So here's to the League.
There's a lot of us out there who are working very, very hard. So we aren't going to give up easily. Mm-hmm. In fact, the League of Women Voters today just issued a press release that we are in a constitutional crisis.
Oh, so. Okay.
Nobody else has said it yet for sure, but we just said it, okay?
Yes, thank you.
Well, good. Good for you to get on board. I've seen a few headlines or a few email subjects of that with that title, but now it's getting more serious. So, well, thank you very much. Listeners can go to the web address, by the way. It's also lwv.org, and you can poke around in there to find Mendocino County. There's a, you can go /California/Mendocino-County, and you'll find some numerous links there who mention about the summarize the League of Women Voters, talk about issues and positions they have on specific issues, and then contact the organization that way, or by going to the email address info@lwvmendo.org.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charlene, for being our guest.
Thank you.
Charlene McAllister from the Coast, and thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. For the second half of today's program, we'll be looking at the national implications of current vote suppression in North Carolina with guests David Neer and Rob Schofield. This is the election. I'm confused at my own copy here. This is the one and only election in the entire nation that is undecided after 5 months since the election day on November 5th. Some very suspicious legal maneuvering has been occurring since the first election result showed one winner by only 735 votes out of over 5 million. For you statisticians, that's a 0.015% difference between the two candidates. And this is for the state Supreme Court, a seat for the state Supreme Court in North Carolina. And that's after two recounts that produced the same result. One was a partial and the other was a complete recount. But again, 735 votes between two candidates out of over 5 million. They don't get much closer than that. And kudos, by the way, to the state's election process for that level of accuracy. Got the same answer both times, actually three times, counting the first count plus two recounts. So that's the good news. But since then, there's some questionable stuff going on. After the election, the losing candidate filed several legal cases to try to reverse the result. And these have national implications for the future of vote suppression in other states. And that brings us to today's guests, who will enlighten us about what in tarnation is going on over there in North Carolina. With us are two guests. Rob Schofield is the editor of NC Newsline. That's a Raleigh, North Carolina-based nonpartisan, nonprofit news outlet dedicated to fearless reporting and hard-hitting commentary. Newsline is an affiliate of States Newsroom. That's the nation's largest state-focused nonprofit news organization. So, Rob Schofield, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And with us also is David Neer. And check my pronunciation on that, by the way. Do you pronounce it Neer?
N-I-R. Oh, you nailed it.
Okay. He's the publisher of The Down Ballot. That's an independent media outlet devoted to covering the thousands of elections below the presidency. And this is sure one of them. So let's have a look at the national implications of current vote suppression in North Carolina. David Neer, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you so much.
And David, I want to start with you. I think the first articles I saw about this were from the Down Ballot. I get your emails, by the way. And that got my attention for sure some weeks ago. And so can you give us the big picture of this as you've seen things develop over the last few months? And I say last few months because this is a topic for which there is, for which there is news and highlights that have come just literally days old. But so can you give us just the big picture of how things developed after November until recently?
Absolutely. Let me just start by saying, Rob, I'm a huge fan of the work you folks do in States Newsroom, and your coverage has been essential to our understanding of what's going on here. So for our listeners, the big picture is this. Democrat Allison Riggs, the incumbent justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, as you were saying, Steve, won election to a full term by 734 votes in November. But her Republican opponent, Jefferson Griffin, has tried to challenge more than 60,000 votes and get them retroactively thrown out. And that word, retroactively, is the most important thing that I want to emphasize here, because all of these votes that Jefferson Griffin, the Republican, is challenging were cast by voters who complied with all of the rules in place at the time in North Carolina for the November election. There's no question of fraud. There's no question of anyone improperly casting a ballot. These folks all played by the rules. I'll give you an example of one big category of voters that Griffin was trying to disqualify. He wanted more than 60,000 ballots thrown out because voters had failed to include their social security numbers or driver's license numbers on their voter registration application. Well, guess what? The state's application form for voter registrations didn't even include this as a field. And so an election officials never went to these voters and said, oh, your registration is missing some important data. These folks had in many cases voted for years, even decades without this information. And of course, there was no fraud at all. To bring us up to speed on the most recent developments, that category of voters, the state Supreme Court, which is dominated by Republicans, said those votes are actually valid. We're not going to throw those out. But there are a couple of other categories of voters, and maybe Rob wants to talk about those a little bit more, where the state Supreme Court has said, oh, these might still get retroactively thrown out and could still overturn the results of this democratically conducted election. And there is still legal wrangling going on, as you pointed out, more than 5 months later, over these remaining categories of voters that Republicans want to retroactively throw out.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me slip in a comment or two, and then we'll move over to Rob. The lack of a driver's license number or the last four of a social security number, I believe it was in one of the articles from Rob's organization that mentioned that this law went into effect in 2004, if I remember one of the articles, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's been around 20 years. And then, but no, none of the articles I read, nothing from the more commercial press no one has said, well, what were people who were already registered in 2004 supposed to do?
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing that said they were supposed to go re-register. So they've been registered at the same place they've been for 20 years, and suddenly they weren't eligible. Or the one party in this election is saying, well, they shouldn't have been counted then. So that's a shock.
Yeah, Rob. Rob, it actually at one point included Justice Riggs' parents. Some people who were deemed to have been unlawfully registered or did. Okay. Certainly it was a snafu. It was you know, clerical errors, things like that. There was absolutely no evidence that any individual voter did anything really wrong. It's really a classic case of someone just trying to take advantage of what their interpretation of the rules, trying to get them applied in a way that they read the law, which is what Judge Griffin was trying to do. And for a time, the court, and actually to a certain extent still, the state Supreme Court was going along with it. So we're in this weird situation now where we've got multiple lawsuits, both in state and federal court. Nobody's quite sure what the final outcome is going to be. We're down to a few thousand, we think, maybe, that still are being challenged, military and overseas voters and so-called never voters, people who actually didn't live in North Carolina, but they were Americans and they had family here. Maybe they'd been born here and had been. These were both categories that in which the rules were not controversial when they were adopted, unanimously adopted by a bipartisan Board of Elections that actually thought and fussed over a lot of stuff, but agreed on this. And indeed, with respect to the military voters, there's a federal law that seemed to, that they were trying to comply with that pretty clearly makes clear that you don't need to provide a photo ID. That's what the whole debate is about, whether these voters should have provided a photo ID. Indeed, there really wasn't a way when you were casting a ballot electronically from overseas to provide a photo ID. So bottom line, as David says, it comes down to this question of whether you can change the election rules after the election, rules that were agreed to by everyone. Now, there might have been some challenges ahead of time, but it was ruled at the time that they weren't going to be able to go forward. So we're just in this very strange situation. Of course, the implications are that if this goes forward, okay, what's next? What other rule might be turned over here in North Carolina and some other jurisdiction after the election? And of course, this is a state Supreme Court election, but what if this had been the presidential election here in North Carolina? What if our presidential election, it staggers the imagination to think where we'd be if that had been the case.
Interesting. So, I'd like to comment on that just to say that, well, there's a big difference between this situation and the year 2000. For presidential elections, there's a deadline. For this, that, you know, it's been 5 months and it could go another 5 months. Who knows? Because it's only in state court. It has gone briefly to a federal judge who made one decision, but not on the bigger picture issues. And it went back to state court.
Was there a regional issue also were there some areas that were targeted in addition to some categories?
Handle that, Dave.
Sure. Yeah, that's another thing here that is really jarring and I think really gets to people's sense of fairness and unfairness here, because it appears that the Republican candidate, Jefferson Griffin, has challenged or directed most of his challenges to Democratic-leaning counties. And so what you wound up with is a situation where only some voters in certain counties of the state are actually being challenged, whereas North Carolina has 100 counties. And so most of these counties are getting off without this same kind of scrutiny. And Steve, it's very apropos that you bring up the 2000 election, because as folks like us will remember, the ruling in Bush v. Gore very clearly said that voters' votes have to be counted in a consistent way statewide. And so the North Carolina Supreme Court, I think, is opening the door to the federal courts coming in and saying, whoa, 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 you're treating different voters differently depending on what county they live in. That's not right. That violates due process and equal protection of the laws. So the mess just seems to keep getting bigger and bigger, in my view.
So I want to bring up a couple of points about this. First of all, I want to repeat the three categories, because I would think that wasn't clear in our first few minutes here. So the overall number of votes being challenged is roughly 65,000, something like that, I believe. Sound close enough?
Yep.
Okay. And over 60,000 of those are in this first category. And that's a category of voters that are registered and voted in person in the state, but did not have a verification of their citizenship recorded with the state in the election system. And that would have been their driver's license number or the last four digits numerals of their social security number. However, all of these people, is my understanding, they all had to show a driver's license or some other ID to vote. So that's the case that the state Supreme Court threw out or judged those votes should be counted. And that was just Friday, a week ago, I believe, just less than a week.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, and that's the big category. So that hurdle is overcome for the time being. Now, the other two categories. I'm sorry?
It looks that way, yes.
It looks that way. Well, for now, and then we'll see where things could go. But for now, we're over that hurdle. So the other categories, one of them is the last number I saw was like 1,200 or something like that, and that's just a few days ago. So I don't know. Rob is looking a little questionable here. So it's between 2,000 to 7,000. Now let me say that those are voters who live overseas. They're absentee ballots who did not provide the same ID information, either the driver's license number or a photo of that, their driver's
license. It's a photo ID that they didn't, that's the challenge, that they did not provide a photo ID.
For which there was apparently no way to do that voting absentee. and that brings up the issue of the office. I'm sorry, now I forget the name of it, but you know, the
State Board of Elections.
State Board of Elections. Thank you. What the State Board of Elections is doing versus what the one side of this legal issue thinks they ought to be doing. But anyway, so these people, right as of last Friday, I believe this number of 2,000 to 7,000, whatever it is, certainly enough to change the 734 vote difference right now. They are having to provide this information, and they have 30 days to provide it, I believe. And
well, that's kind of on hold, but that was the ruling. Yes, we're okay. Not. We're still waiting for that to actually take effect, and it's been appealed. So,
oh, that's we'll okay. So that's latest information, because I believe that was decided a Saturday, I think, by a.
Yeah, Riggs has taken this to federal court, and we're now there's an appeal pending, I believe, at the Fourth Circuit. So we've got parallel cases in both the state courts and the federal courts at this point.
This is juicy. Well, when we will come back to that more, that's a particular, you know, topic of interest. The third group I should mention, though, it's only 150-ish or something like that.
It's more like 300. Is it that many? 66 is a number that we've seen a lot.
Okay. Yeah. And those are voters who were registered, who have never lived in the state of North Carolina and possibly never lived in the United States. They are typically family, siblings or sons and daughters of registered voters who were born overseas and lived overseas, you know, when they grew up and stayed overseas when parents came back to the state. But they registered as they are U.S. citizens, apparently. So they think they should have some right to vote. But the courts have said just again a week ago or so that those voters should not be counted. So that's the third category. So that's the ones I hope are clear to voters. The big one, over 60,000, those votes are going to be counted. The middle quantity, 2 to 7,000, we're not sure exactly yet. That's on hold. But the decision a week or so ago was that they would have to cure their votes. That's called curing to listeners. And they had up to 30 days, but that's on hold. And then this third group, the smallest group, not enough to change the 735 vote majority, but they're not going to be able to vote at all. At least that's the current legal status, is my understanding. So did I get that close?
I think you're doing really well.
Okay. And then some of these, I don't know if all three categories apply to one county, one particular county whose name escapes me, but one particular county or others. And so can somebody comment on that?
The middle category you've described of the overseas and military voters, mm-hmm. The challenge that Griffin initially filed was in Guilford County. That's the town, okay. City of Greensboro. It's a mid-sized city, one of our larger counties, mm-hmm. A Democratic county that Riggs won by about 25 points. Mm-hmm. If it's only that county, the number probably isn't enough to change the outcome, and that's the interpretation that the State Board of Elections has been moving forward with. Griffin says, no, there were some other counties I wanted to challenge too, which happen to be Democratic counties also. He's saying, I just couldn't get to any of those other counties. I didn't have enough time to get the appeal filed in those other areas. That's why it's just these counties. Others are more suspicious than there's it's a strange coincidence that they were all Democratic counties that he initially challenged.
Isn't that interesting?
And David,
David, any comment on that?
Obviously we are speaking tongue firmly in cheek here. There's no question about exactly what Griffin is hoping to accomplish with his particular targets. But this is also why we don't even know how many voters are being challenged. And this is another huge problem here, because it's just not clear how many counties he actually is successfully even lodged his complaints in on time. And like Rob was just saying, there is a dispute between him and the State Board of Elections now, and now that's going back before the courts as well. And this is something that a Republican justice on the Supreme Court, I see Rob nodding along for our listeners. We're on video here.
Rob
knows exactly who I'm going to talk about. But Richard Dietz, who is a Republican justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, he filed this dissenting opinion in which he said that he thinks that Griffin's challenges are probably right on the merits, but this is completely the wrong time to bring them, precisely because of the mischief. And I'm almost certain that that's the exact word that he used. The mischief that these after the fact challenges can cause. And we're seeing the mischief because we're some very smart folks here, and we're all struggling to describe this wild, chaotic set of cases in multiple courts with multiple challenges, and we don't even know how many votes are up for grabs. The point is, if you want to challenge the election rules and say that these are unconstitutional, they violate the state constitution or the federal constitution, you got to do it before Election Day.
Judge Dietz's quote from his, I quoted in a column I wrote this week, he said, "By every measure, this is the most impactful election-related court decision our state has seen in decades. It cries out for our full review and for a decisive rejection of this sort of post hoc judicial tampering in election results." This is a sort of a non-MAGA Republican on the state Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if other states are going to look at this and go, oh, this is interesting, we should do that. It might be a new playbook, right? For voter suppression.
Such an opportunity for mischief in future elections.
Yeah, mischief is the perfect word because they're taking Social Security apart just by making it dysfunctional. And this sounds like it's making elections dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've been a petri dish for a lot of reactionary ideas over the last decade and a half in North Carolina, so wouldn't it all surprise me? We've seen a lot of the things that got their start here wind their way,
yes,
both to other states and indeed to Congress.
Yeah, and we followed the work, some of the goings-on in Georgia in recent years with a guest we had last month, Greg Pallast, if you know about his work at all, about vote challenging before an election, but they're done in secret, so you don't know who lost their vote till maybe afterwards, if at all. But that's how some votes are tossed out before an election. Would someone like to address the issue then of quote unquote equal protection of the law?
This is what I was getting at earlier, talking about Bush versus
Gore. This is David Neer to listeners.
All voters, in essence, just have to be treated equally. And this is a huge problem with Griffin's challenges, that he wants different types of voters and different voters in different geographies to be treated differently. And like I say, I think that is potentially a huge problem for the federal courts, because what happened in the federal courts is that Riggs, the Democrat, tried to get the case removed from state court to federal court. She said, this is a matter for the federal courts to decide because it implicates voting rights under the federal constitution. Mm-hmm. And the federal courts largely demurred on that. And what they said was, let's let the state courts handle things. And then if there are still any issues left over when the state courts have had their say, then we'll weigh in. Well, it was extremely predictable that we're getting to the end of the line with the state courts. And of course, there are huge federal issues still remaining, which is probably why it would have been wise for the federal courts just to take over the matter in the first place so that they could resolve everything once and for all. The judge hearing the case on the federal side is a Trump appointee. He hasn't been particularly favorable to Riggs, but the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals is very divided. Joe Biden got a lot of appointees on that court while he was president, so she might get a more favorable hearing from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. But, I think you were saying earlier, this could go on for another 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
It could, and that's another disaster, because we should have certainty in our elections. And certainty doesn't mean that everything gets decided on election night. You have to be methodical and careful in counting all of the votes and counting them all the right way. But at a certain point, things just go on for far too long. The one good thing here in terms of democratic stability is, I say that with a small d, is that during the pendency of this challenge, Riggs has still been serving on the state Supreme Court. She's recused herself from any matters involving this particular challenge, but she is still a sitting justice on the court while this case plays out.
Mm-hmm.
So I could mention one other sort of obvious equal protection issue that sort of got lost in all this is the fact that the initial challenge to the 60,000 some votes, well, he could only challenge people who voted absentee as a practical matter, because when you vote in person, you just put your ballot in the box. It can't be rediscovered. There's no identifier. It disappears into the mass.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously this, if you want to make this argument that it was improper for people to not have had their social security number or their driver's license, associated with their registration, same rule should have applied to everybody. But the only reason the only challenge, absentee ballots is because those are the only ones we could identify, that because they vote in a different way. They're not just thrown into a big box. If we had just done that and thrown them all into a big box, then maybe this wouldn't have been an issue.
Was I incorrect initially about the 60,000 number that they are local in-state absentee ballots? Absentee voters?
Right. No, you're right. They are.
They're oh, they are. Okay. So I was incorrect about
in-state.
That.
In-state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So they did not necessarily.
As opposed to in person.
Yeah.
So presumably on April 28th, that's when the 30-day opportunity to cure your ballot starts. Do you want to talk a little bit about how effective the cure is?
That's on hold, though, isn't it?
Is that on hold?
No, I think we're still sort of waiting to see if that actually takes effect
actually
at
happens.
This point.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. There's a process that campaigns engage in many states, which have cure periods for normal reasons. You know, your signature on your absentee ballot allegedly doesn't match the signature on file at the election clerk's office. And so you get notified after the election, and then you have a period, a week, 2 weeks, whatever it might be, usually fairly short. 30 days is quite long to cure the problem. And campaigns are very experienced at this. They call it the ballot chase, that after a close election, they will figure out from election officials whose ballots are potentially being subject to getting tossed out. And they will go and reach out to the voters they think are favorable to them to try to help them correct the problems. Because what the notice looks like, it's typically you get something like a postcard in the mail. And the Board of Elections has also said they want to try to email voters. They don't necessarily have their email addresses. They want to try to call them on the phone. They might not have the phone numbers. And people, of course, rarely pick up the phone these days when it's a strange number calling. So the notice process is it's important, but there's only so much that the state election officials can do. What I can guarantee you is that if this cure period does at some point take effect, that the Riggs campaign will devote every resource to tracking down every single one of these voters, at least the ones that they think might have voted for her. And it's going to be a ballot chase like you've never seen, in part because, Steve, as you were saying, the number ultimately is going to be not that huge if it does wind up happening. It's still a travesty, don't get me wrong, from the perspective of democracy. These voters, if your ballot's been questioned, you're going to hear from someone about it.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like it's more of a treatment than a cure.
My understanding is that those people are already identified. So there's no reason people can't be contacting them saying, get ready.
So we're not sure, though, how many we're going to actually be challenged.
Oh, okay.
And we're still, remember, there's still this, we're not clear on what the number is going to be. The State Board of Elections is sort of saying, okay, well, let's do these based upon what the ruling is. And Griffin's appealed that, saying, oh, no, there are more counties that need to be challenged. So that's why this 2 to 7,000. So okay. We don't know.
And, you know, Rob, there's one other issue with those never resident voters that I'm sure you're keenly aware of, that North Carolina journalist Brian Anderson has brought to the forefront, which is that this is that smallest group that's maybe 300 or fewer voters who allegedly never lived in North Carolina. And I emphasize allegedly because Brian Anderson, along with Judd Legum, another independent journalist, has discovered dozens of these folks who have actually lived in North Carolina in the past. And they might have gotten flagged incorrectly for a variety of reasons as to why Griffin thinks that they are quote unquote never residents. But there's evidence of these people having voted in person in North Carolina in recent years.
Wow.
So that's another huge problem with these challenges, is that the data isn't necessarily right. There are a lot of questions about the accuracy of his challenges. And so it really just adds to all the confusion here, because there are many, many valid votes that are at risk of getting thrown out. And the term for that really is election subversion, because we know what the election results were, and there are people who are trying to overturn that election after the fact.
Mm-hmm. One question I have is, it's about something that didn't happen. There's one of the articles, and only one of the articles that I read, mentioned that the challenge and the suits and such were filed by a deadline. And what I read nothing about, there's no mention of the other side, the winning side, filing any cases about the similar voters, but in red counties, so to speak. And that brings up a general question. Well, what's up with that? And a corollary question is, well, did they file that super last minute so that they could sneak it in by the deadline and not trigger the other side, the Democratic side? It didn't give him time to react to that. What can anyone tell us about that?
Well, you know, I think Justice Riggs has been clear from the start. She wants everybody's vote to be counted. She doesn't want to throw out votes. Mm-hmm. That's sort of been the premise of her defense here, right from the start. Mm-hmm. She wants every vote counted. And it would be inconsistent for her to start saying, okay, well, then let's tit for tat. Let's start throwing out votes in Republican mm-hmm. counties. She mm-hmm. wants everybody's vote to be counted. And so I think she's been consistent on that. I think that's been part of the strength of her. She's done a good job, I think an unusually good job for mm-hmm. our mealy-mouthed Democrats these days in sort of speaking up in this incident and has been very public about what's really at stake here.
I should mention to listeners that this is Justice Riggs. She is currently on the Supreme Court, and she is the incumbent in this election. By the way, and the elections for Supreme Court, there are partisan events, which is a surprise, you know, to me. I was not familiar with that in our state here of California. But she spent years in her past of her career defending voting rights and helping to prosecute this kind of shenanigan as an independent working for organizations that are pro-democracy and pro-voter. So that is my understanding of her background. I do not know about the other candidate.
Judge Griffin, Griffin is a conservative court of appeals judge, sort of typical conservative Republican mm-hmm. resume.
Okay.
You know, and I think there's one thing really worth stressing, and you were getting at this earlier, that this really is setting up a playbook for other elections in other states. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all remember the infamous Trump call to Georgia's Secretary of State about finding 11,780 votes. Right. That's essentially what Griffin is trying to do here. You know, mm-hmm. finding the votes, you know, Trump made it sound like he wanted the Secretary of State to stuff the ballot box, but you can also find the votes by deleting votes for the other side. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening here. And I want to point out it's happening without any involvement from Trump whatsoever. And but Republicans in so many states, they understand that this is the playbook, that this is their way forward, mm-hmm. that this is how they want to try to deal with election losses. And the amazing thing here is that Republicans have currently a 5-2 majority on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. So, and that's if Riggs holds on. So they would have a wide majority on the Supreme Court, even if Riggs wins. So it's either 5-2 or 6-1, and they're not content with 5-2. You know, it would be a number of years before Democrats would have a shot at winning back the North Carolina Supreme Court, mm-hmm. But they just want to maximize every single advantage here. So this kind of tactic, this ex post facto retroactive attempt to overturn mm-hmm. an election, is something to be on the lookout for in all 50 states.
Okay, well, we need to head toward the wrap-up here. That, by the way, was David Neer. He's the publisher of The Down Ballot, and that is available online at thedownballot.org. Com, what are you there?
The-downballot.com.
Okay.
Good stuff.
All right, super. And Rob Schofield, and you are with NC Newsline. How is your work found there?
NCNewsline.com.
All right.
That simple. Well, listen, can we make a date for 5 months from now?
Just hope this will be settled before the end of the 8-year Supreme Court term. That's my objective.
Indeed. Well, we are just out of time here. Thanks to our guests and thanks for listeners. And we'll be back in a few next month on May 15th, I believe it is, Corporations and Democracy. And good night.